For this Wednesday, June 24th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. Senate Democrats blocking a Republican police reform bill, leaving both sides at odds on how to proceed. We'll have the latest just ahead. And with the Democrats threatening a subpoena, the Attorney General Bill Barr confirming today he will testify before the House Judiciary Committee on July 28th. It comes on the same day with an often contentious hearing, with career Justice Department officials testifying and at times offering a harsh assessment on the current Attorney General. Meanwhile, the European Union appears to be on the brink of barring travelers from the United States when nations including Germany, France, and Italy begin to reopen their borders next week. We'll have reaction from the Secretary of State. And baseball returns, but the New York City Marathon has been canceled. The story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill, where Senate Democrats today blocking a Republican police reform bill. Today's action leaves the legislation basically in limbo, both sides digging in. The vote on the Senate floor, 55-45, with two Democrats and one independent voting with the Republicans to advance the legislation. Those senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Doug Jones of Alabama, who, by the way, is up for re-election this year, and independent Angus King of Maine. The House will vote tomorrow on a Democratic bill, which is expected to pass along a party-line vote. TheHill.com quoting Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who said, quote, "If we can't do it now, I don't know when we'll ever do it." His colleague from South Carolina, Tim Scott, taking the lead on this GOP legislation. His comments from the Senate floor.
I'm just here to tell you that if we're going to be serious about criminal justice reform, and we passed it with the House, the Senate, and the White House in the hands of Republicans. We passed criminal justice reform to make up for the Democrat bill, the 1994 crime bill, that locked up disproportionately African-American men. The Republican Party passed criminal justice reform with all three levers in our hands. I'm frustrated. Because it's not a competition for the best ideas. It's not a competition for how to improve the poorest performing schools in America in the public education system that is consistently in black and brown communities, that your zip code determines the outcome of your life because you're not going to have a good education, because we won't touch teachers' unions, we won't touch education in the way that it needs to be touched. Governor Scott did before he was a senator. One of the reasons I went down there and campaigned for him, because he was serious about helping poor kids get up and move on. Let me just close with this. I don't know what it's going to take to wake up an entire nation about the importance of a duopoly and not a monopoly. Because look at your results. Look at the results you're getting. And by the way, when this bill is gone and next week we're on the DOD or something else, we'll forget about this. We'll move on. People will forget about it. And you know what's going to happen? Something bad. And we'll be right back here talking about what should have been done, what could have been done, why we must act now. I'm telling you, I had this conversation 5 years ago. I'm having this conversation right now. We could do something right now. You know, here's the truth. In Detroit, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, all these cities could have banned chokeholds themselves. They could have increased the police reporting themselves. They could have more data information themselves. They could have de-escalation training themselves. They could have duty to intervene themselves, Minneapolis as well. All these communities have been run by Democrats for decades. Decades. What is the ROI for the poorest people in this nation? And I don't blame them. I blame an elite political class with billions of dollars to do whatever they want to do, and look at the results for the poorest, most vulnerable people in our nation. I'm willing to compete for their vote. Are you?
We carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2, and that from Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. But Senate Democrats claiming that the GOP bill doesn't go far enough in reining in the abuse or misuse of power by law enforcement officials. And Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell would not agree to a deal with the Democrats on some specific amendments before today's initial vote that would have allowed the legislation to proceed on the Senate floor. With more reaction on that side of the story, here is Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Why are these bills not being taken up in committee with a Republican majority and debated and marked up and reported to the floor in a bipartisan way? I serve on the Armed Services Committee. That's what we do every year with the NDAA. We introduce it. We let members have the ability to offer amendments that can be voted on by a simple majority vote in committee. We get to the end of a process, and when no one has an amendment left, we then have a final bill, and then we vote it out overwhelmingly bipartisan. The NDAA came out of committee 2 weeks ago on a 26-2 vote. We'll be taking it up on the floor. I'm on the HELP committee. I have a wonderful chair in ranking in Senators Alexander and Senators Murray, and we tackle tough issues with a committee that has some big personalities on it. And I've got a couple of them in the room with me now, and some great ideological diversity on that committee. But we take up tough issues, and we don't always solve them, but we usually do. And when we put our mind to it, we report something to the floor, and we do it in a bipartisan way. And when it comes in a bipartisan way, there's a great chance that we get action here on the floor. That's the right way to do things. It respects the traditions of the body because it is a majority that runs the committee, but it allows those who have devoted themselves to help issues or armed services issues or judiciary issues to offer their thoughts. When these bills were introduced, I assumed that a committee ably led by Senators Graham and Feinstein would put these bills together and have a markup and let people offer amendments with a 50% vote threshold and then report out a bipartisan bill. Why would the Judiciary Committee not do it? I believe the leaders of the committee wanted to do it, but I believe they were told not to do it. They were told, we're not going to use the committee process on this. We're going to force this to a floor vote, a snap vote, and then when it goes down, we will say, Democrats killed it, it's all over, move on to the next issue. This is only over for anyone who wants it to be over.
From the Senate floor earlier today, and joining us on the phone from Capitol Hill is Marianne Levine. She is following this story for Politico. At the moment, it appears both parties are deadlocked. Why?
Well, it seems like while both parties want to do some type of police reform, there seems to be a real deadlock in terms of how to go about it. Senate Republicans today put their bill on the floor. The Democrats blocked because they basically said that they wanted the Republicans to negotiate with them at the outset. And they questioned what the point was of voting on a bill that was not bipartisan from the get-go. Now, what Senate Republicans countered to that was that the bill was that this was basically just a procedural vote and the bill would have been amenable. But there's a serious partisan difference in terms of how both parties are approaching how to legislate on this and how to approach really addressing police reform.
Well, at a news conference after the vote on the floor earlier today, this from the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer of New York.
What has to be in a police reform bill for Democrats to support it? What are your red lines?
Well, look at the red lines. We don't draw red lines. Look at the Justice and Policing Act. That is a good bill. We'd like to see it pass.
Does the failure today make...
I couldn't hear you, ma'am.
Does the failure today make it easier to begin negotiations?
I think so. You know, Mitch McConnell has a way of trying to bully us around. And he thinks he can get his way. And if past his prologue, all this year and last year when he tried on a major issue, our caucus held together. And each time he came back, whether it was the last three COVID bills And there are many, many other instances. And I believe that the Republican Party sees the handwriting on the wall. They see what the American people feel. And they know now that while the House is going to succeed in passing a bill, the Senate won't. And that falls on McConnell's shoulders. He's the Senate leader. He knows how to pass a bill. He set up something here so it wouldn't pass. The blame, more than on anyone else, falls on McConnell's shoulders for not being a straight shooter on this one. But I think now there's a real chance that he failed at his gambit, that the people in his caucus and, more importantly, the people of America will put pressure, moral pressure, political pressure, every kind of pressure on him, and he may come back and say, let's negotiate a good bill. That's our hope, our prayer, and what we will work for.
What's your reaction? Do you think it was appropriate for Speaker Pelosi to say that Republicans are, quote, getting away with murder?
Pelosi's answered that question herself, and whatever what she said was fine with me.
That's it. Okay. Yes.
I was going to follow up on Sarah's question. Do you think that it's still possible that we could see a police reform bill this Congress?
Yes, I think it's a better chance than people think, because the kids are out there in the streets, the adults are out there in the streets. America's moral suasion. We're a moral country fundamentally. We get off track all the time, but when our better angels are appealed to, is what's happening now. We often rise to the occasion, and I think the Senate can. As long as Mitch McConnell sees the light. Yes.
What are you going to do next today? Are you going to reach out to Majority Leader McConnell? Are you going to wait for him to come to you?
We're certainly going to try to talk with many of us. We'll be talking with our Republican colleagues about the path forward.
That from the Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today. Marianne Levine, will there be more negotiations? Will both sides be able to come together?
It's hard to say. If I had to predict, I would say probably not. I think there's a lot of partisan frustration right now with the process. I think Republicans are resentful that Democrats didn't want to vote on a motion to proceed today to move on this bill. They say that having an open amendment process would have given them the negotiating power that they've wanted. But it seems like Chuck Schumer today is suggesting that there could potentially be some agreement in the future. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell also voted down the motion to proceed today, which is a procedural move that allows him to bring it back up whenever he wants. So it seems like they're not closing the door completely, but it also doesn't seem like there's going to be any progress on the Senate side in the near future, at least from what we can tell from our reporting.
And, of course, it is an election year, as you point out, quote, Senate Republicans accusing the Democrats of wanting to campaign on the issue, saying that if they wanted to improve the bill, they could do so through the amendment process. But could they? Was that an option?
It's hard to say, because anything that they would have wanted to do would have required 60 votes. And their question, and what they really asked was, you know, why put a product that's not bipartisan on the floor from the get-go? Usually in the Senate, what they argue is that if you really want to see a piece of legislation get through, it should be bipartisan from the start. And so I think that they viewed that process as flawed from the start and didn't want to cooperate because they felt like they were being jammed into having to vote on this. And while they were promised amendment votes, the Democrats, I think, we're worried that they would not be able to meet the 60-vote threshold to actually pass any substantive legislation.
What was the biggest sticking point between the two parties today? If there was one issue, what was it?
I think there were a handful of issues. I think qualified immunity is qualified immunity was probably the biggest issue. Basically, the Democratic bill, both in the Senate and the House, would limit qualified immunity for police officers and make it easier for individuals to take legal action in light of police misconduct. And so that was something that Democrats basically said was non-negotiable, that this moment was about police accountability. And that was a key sticking point with Republicans, who did not want to move forward on qualified immunity. And that really, I think, helped sink a lot of the negotiations. Some Republicans appeared open to a less sweeping form of qualified immunity, but it seemed that's kind of where a lot of Republicans drew the line.
This headline at Politico.com as the Democrats sink the GOP police bill, leaving the Senate deadlocked as the country reckons with racism. Marianne Levine, she is on Capitol Hill this Wednesday. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also today, a divided federal appeals court ordering the dismissal of the case against former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, despite twice pleading guilty for lying to the FBI about his conversations with then-Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the presidential transition. The Justice Department moving last month to dismiss the case against him in what is being viewed as a victory for Flynn and the Trump administration. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit said that the judge in this case overstepped his role and committed, quote, a clear legal error by refusing to immediately close the case and instead appointing a former judge to argue against the Justice Department's position. Ellie Honig is a CNN legal analyst and former federal prosecutor. He offered this analysis earlier today.
I am a bit surprised, Jim, and I do see politics, but I think it's important that people understand the decision that just came out from the Court of Appeals, what it is and is not. What it is a procedural decision. The ruling is, like it or not, it's up to the Justice Department, not the judiciary, not judges, to decide whether to proceed with a prosecution here. What the decision is not is essentially a blessing or saying that everything that happened in Flynn is okay. The court does not address that. And if you look at what happened in Michael Flynn, it's completely abnormal. It's completely unacceptable to have the Justice Department come in for a defendant who has pled guilty and say, now we want to drop the case. That is not normal. That is not okay. The court opinion today does not bless that.
That from CNN earlier today and one of their legal analysts. And at the White House, this reaction from the president, who this morning on Twitter called the ruling, quote, great.
In the coronavirus?
I'm very happy about General Flynn. He was treated horribly. He was treated very, very horribly by a group of very bad people. And I think you'll see things are going to start to come out. But what happened to General Flynn should never happen again in our country. He was persecuted, and many other people were persecuted. They spied on a campaign, and they should never spy on a campaign, to put it mildly. It never happened before in the history of our country. The Obama administration spied on a campaign. This is just the first one. He's been exonerated. And I want to congratulate him. He's been through a lot. He's been through a lot. He had great courage, great fortitude. But they spied on a campaign. There's never been anything like that happen. If that were the other way around, people would be in jail for 50 years already.
That from the president earlier today, and Flynn's attorney, Sidney Powell, saying that she was delighted to see that the rule of law applied by the D.C. Circuit. In money news, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, today painting a bleak picture of the global economy, saying that the coronavirus pandemic has caused more widespread damage than expected and will be followed by a sluggish recovery. The global economy, according to the IMF, will shrink by nearly 5%. That, by the way, is worse than the 3% decline predicted back in April. With reaction on Wall Street, the Dow losing more than 710 points. The Nasdaq was down 222. The S&P off by nearly 81. In just 24 hours, the U.S. has reported a nearly 36,000 new cases of COVID-19. That is a single-day high. Nine states are leading that list, including California, Florida, and Missouri. And the governors of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut today announcing that they are imposing a 14-day quarantine on visitors from states with high coronavirus infection rates. The order in New York, for example, will take in the form of a travel advisory. It goes into effect at midnight. Here's Governor Andrew Cuomo.
No one else had to accomplish as much as we had to accomplish in such a short period of time. No one else had to bend the curve as much as we had to bend the curve. And when people take a deep breath and the political rhetoric dies down, those are going to be the facts. So I applaud my colleagues for doing an extraordinary job. We now have to make sure that the rate continues to drop. And that's what keeps me up at night, and I'm sure keeps them up at night. So we have to make sure we're doing everything and we're diligent and our citizens are diligent. We also have to make sure the virus doesn't come in on a plane again. Learn that lesson, been there, done that. So we're announcing today a joint travel advisory. People coming in from states that have a high infection rate must quarantine for 14 days. And we have a calibration for the infection rate. And any state that goes over that infection rate, that state will be subject to the quarantine. It's only for the simple reason that we worked very hard to get the viral transmission rate down. We don't want to see it go up because a lot of people come into this region and they could literally bring the infection with them. It wouldn't be malicious or malevolent, but it would still be real. So we are jointly instituting that travel advisory today, because what happens in New York happens in New Jersey, happens in Connecticut. And I think it's right, and I think it's smart, and I'm glad that we're doing it together. And we've done a lot of good things together, and hopefully we're on the other side of this mountain, and we'll continue to see the numbers go down, and we'll continue to see the economic activity go up.
And that from Governor Andrew Cuomo. And those nine states that fit the criteria: Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Washington, Utah, and Texas. But according to the CDC, now more than two dozen states are seeing a surge in coronavirus cases. Also today, Bayer, the world's largest seed and pesticide maker, has agreed to pay more than $10 billion to settle thousands of claims here in the U.S. that its popular weed killer Roundup causes cancer. Now, the figure includes over $1 billion to deal with potential future claims from people who used Roundup and may develop a form of cancer known as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the years to come. The company based in Germany bought Monsanto 2 years ago, which produces the product. You're listening to Washington Today. On C-SPAN's The Weekly, author, columnist, the co-founder of The American Conservative, and advisor to three Republican presidents, our conversation with Pat Buchanan, who has played a key role in previous winning presidential campaigns and twice sought the GOP nomination for himself. He offers this advice to President Trump in his 2020 re-election effort.
There's two things he has to do, I think, to be successful. Number one, the economy's got to continue on sort of the V-shaped curve that it started back up on. That has to happen. Secondly, there has to be no second wave of this coronavirus, because I think the country would be so despondent if it broke out again in September and October that it might say we just have to change.
Pat Buchanan joins us on C-SPAN's The Weekly. You can find it on our free radio app or on the web at cspan.org/podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review us, and remember to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. For this Wednesday, June 24th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. A new national poll showing Joe Biden increasing his lead over President Trump. And Politico is reporting on the battleground states, Ohio and Wisconsin, two states that Donald Trump won in 2016. But right now, according to the surveys, Joe Biden is favored over the president. More on the race just ahead. In yesterday's New York Democratic primary, veteran Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel appears to be on the verge of losing his seat in the 16th congressional district. And she became one of the leading figures behind the 2016 hit movie Hidden Figures. Today, NASA announcing it will be renaming its Washington, D.C. headquarters after Mary Jackson, the agency's first black woman engineer. She died back in 2005 at the age of 83, but the movie bringing her story to the nation and to the world. And now to today's House Judiciary Committee hearing, in which two Justice Department officials deliver testimony accusing political appointees in the Trump administration of intervening in criminal and antitrust cases to serve the personal interests of the president and the Attorney General, Bill Barr. It's highly unusual for current officials to testify before Congress and criticize department leadership. The New York Times pointing out that Democrats say the hearing is part of a broader investigation into the Attorney General's leadership of the department. We should point out, just last Friday, the president firing the attorney for the Southern District of New York. That division was leading several investigations into Trump associates, including former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Also at today's hearing, Donald Ayer, who served as the deputy attorney general under President George H.W. Bush before he was ousted and replaced by Bill Barr back in 1990. He told lawmakers, for example, that removing government whistleblowers totally undermines public trust in our system. Here's a portion of his opening statement.
Good afternoon, Chairman Nadler, Ranking Member Jordan, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for inviting me to appear today. I was privileged to serve in the Department of Justice under two Republican and one Democratic president, and I am here because I believe that William Barr poses the greatest threat in my lifetime to our rule of law and to public trust in it. That is because he does not believe in its core principle, that no person is above the law. Instead, since taking office, he has worked to advance his lifelong conviction that the president should hold virtually autocratic powers. That includes immunity from nearly all checks and balances and being able to accord special treatment to himself and his friends. The system that Barr is working to tear down was put in place in the aftermath of the Watergate scandals, which involved extensive government corruption and caused a widespread loss of trust. After Nixon resigned, President Ford's Attorney General Edward Leavy acted swiftly to restore trust by supporting reforms to prevent such abuses.
And that was just part of the opening statement. And then during today's House Judiciary Committee hearing, Texas Congressman Louie Gohmert, Republican, trying to drown out Attorney Ayers' testimony, at times repeatedly banging on his desk. Here is how that moment unfolded. You'll also hear reaction from Committee Chair Jerry Nadler of New York.
And Barr's own role in the events in Lafayette Park come quickly to mind. So does his practice of regularly shrouding himself in the rhetoric and trappings of the rule of law, even as he desecrates and undermines the institutions that make it possible. But to me, Barr's crowning dishonesty is the portrait of Edward Leavy that a recent New York Times article showed hanging on the wall of his conference room, as though the current incumbent
Regular order. The witness will conclude.
Regular order is right.
We're way beyond regular order.
The witness will continue.
Can I have one more sentence here?
By all means.
Okay. But to me, Barr's crowning dishonesty is the portrait of Edward Leavy that a
Mr.
recent
Chairman, I would
New York
ask
Times
that the sergeant at arms
the witness
be called upon to stop the disruption of this meeting. I can't hear this witness. This is a very important witness.
Yeah, well, he's way beyond
the chair.
And if there are no rules about when people can talk, there's no rules about when you can make noise.
The gentleman makes a good point, and the chair will enforce the five-minute rule. Witness will proceed.
The chair is not enforcing the five-minute rule.
The witness will conclude.
Mr. Chairman, this is outrageous. Do you have no respect for the rules whatsoever?
The witness will conclude.
He's 2 minutes beyond concluding, and you don't let us have that kind of time. You gavel down immediately. You're being grossly unfair. This man had a written statement, and he knew to cut it to 5 minutes. He couldn't do it. Either we have rules or we don't.
The gentleman will suspend. The witness will conclude.
Thank you.
Well, then we
can keep
making noise.
In closing, it needs to be said that Bill Barr does regularly lie in ways that impact official action.
Mr. Chairman, there's not order in the room. There's a banging.
No, there's certainly not.
Mr. Chairman, would you have Gene Krupa removed?
The gentleman, the witness will conclude.
That's what you said a while ago, and he didn't conclude.
The gentleman will suspend. The witness will conclude.
So the last thing I want to sum up with, I've said all the rest of this, but the last point I'd like to make is that I think his crowning dishonesty in the face of what he is doing to the Justice Department is the picture that I saw in the New York Times a few weeks ago, a portrait of Edward Leavy on the wall of his conference room, as though the current incumbent has anything but disdain for the beliefs and achievements of his predecessor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And that's how it unfolded. Again, the former Deputy Attorney General from the George H.W. Bush administration, who was fired by Bill Barr, and the banging on the desk was Congressman Louie Gohmert. He's a Republican from Texas. You also heard from Congressman Hank Johnson and the committee chair, Jerry Nadler, that from the House Judiciary Committee. At one point, also of those testifying, Aaron Zelinsky. He is a career prosecutor who worked on the Russia investigation, and he told the House Judiciary Committee that senior law enforcement officials intervened to seek a more lenient prison sentence for one of the president's longtime friends, Roger Stone. Attorney Zelinsky was among four career prosecutors who withdrew in protest from the Stone case after political appointees led by the Attorney General in the Justice Department overrode their recommendations that Roger Stone receive a 7 to 9 year prison sentence in line with standard sentencing guidelines. The day after prosecutors made their request, the Justice Department then submitting a new, more lenient recommendation to the judge deciding what punishment to impose. Here's part of what he told the committee.
The first thing that every AUSA learns
that we treat every defendant equally and fairly. In the United States of America, we do not prosecute people based on politics, and we don't cut them a break based on politics either. But that wasn't what happened here. Roger Stone was treated differently because of politics. At the time of these events, February of 2020, I was a career assistant United States attorney, as I am proud to be now. I was not privy to discussions with political leadership at the Department of Justice. My understanding of what happened is based on two things, what I saw and what I heard. What I saw was that Roger Stone was being treated differently from every other defendant. He received breaks that are, in my experience, unheard of, and all the more so for a defendant in his circumstances, a defendant who lied to Congress, who remained unrepentant, and who made threats against a judge and a witness in his case. And what I heard repeatedly was that this leniency was happening because of Stone's relationship to the president, that the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia was receiving heavy pressure from the highest levels of the Department of Justice, and that his instructions to us were based on political considerations. And I was told that the acting U.S. attorney was giving Stone a break because he was afraid of the president of the United States. I believe that was wrong, and together with my fellow line prosecutors, I immediately and repeatedly said so. Unfortunately, our objections were not heeded. First, we were pressured to reduce the initial sentencing guidelines calculation for Mr. Stone without any clear legal rationale for doing so. When we refused to go along, we were instructed instead to disregard the guidelines entirely and to recommend an unspecified sentence, lower sentence for Mr. Stone. I was told that to the best of anyone's recollection, such a recommendation has never been made by the Fraud and Public Corruption section of the United States Attorney's Office.
That from Aaron Zielinski, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland, testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. We carried it live on the C-SPAN networks. It's available on our website at cspan.org. Is all of this paying a price? Is the president paying a price for this? Well, in campaign 2020, a New York Times Siena College poll showing that former Vice President Joe Biden now has a commanding lead, national lead, over President Trump in the 2020 race. The survey indicates that the Democratic candidate is building a wide advantage among women and non-white voters and making some deep inroads with some traditionally Republican-leaning groups that have shifted away from the president, in part following his response to the coronavirus pandemic. Joe Biden is currently ahead of the president by 14 percentage points at 50% compared to 36% for President Trump. The New York Times writing the following quote, "That is among the most dismal showings of the president and a sign that he is the clear underdog right now in the fight for a second term." The survey, by the way, has a sample of more than 1,300 registered voters. Well, last night in a joint fundraiser held virtually with former President Obama and his one-time running mate Joe Biden, Barack Obama telling more than 175,000 people, most of them small donors, who helped raise more than $11 million for the Biden campaign. Here's a portion of the president's remarks.
You know, so many of us feel as we look at the news and we talk to our friends and neighbors and those who are hurting. And I am here to say that help is on the way if we do the work, because there's nobody that I trust more to be able to heal this country and get it back on track than my dear friend Joe Biden. I don't think I have to reiterate the situation that we find ourselves in right now. Things were tough in 2008, 2009. We were going through the worst recession since the Great Depression, a massive financial crisis. We were still in the midst of two wars. We're overcoming a decade in which the possibilities of common work and common purpose had been diminished and downgraded, and government had been starved of the resources that were needed to make us a more equal and just and compassionate society. And yet, I have to say that the foundation stones, the institutions that we had in place, were still more or less intact. My predecessor, who I disagreed with on a whole host of issues, still had a basic regard for the rule of law and the importance of our institutions' democracy. On the world stage, there was still a sense that America needed to lead, and that that leadership meant that, as imperfect as we might be, there were certain ideals and values that we were going to aspire to and advance, and that we cared about human rights, and we cared about battling against the oppression of peoples in distant lands, and that we tried to uphold, both in our own country but around the world, certain core principles around rule of law and the universal dignity of people.
That from former President Barack Obama last night in a virtual fundraiser for the Biden campaign, again raising more than $11 million. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee is out with a new ad going after what they call the radical leftist groups.
I think that we actually do have an ideological frame. We are trained Marxists.
This could be a police cruiser, Tom, that you mentioned that is burning right now.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be.
Flames rip through the lower level of St. John's Church.
And as you can see, there's definitely a fire here.
Make sure that police departments are defunded.
We need to completely dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department.
The driver hit two officers.
We have an incredible opportunity to fundamentally transform the country.
The first statue that we came across was Ulysses Grant. It was toppled. It was lying in the pathway.
Look what you did to my store. These people are tearing up our livelihood.
We are trained Marxists.
That from the Republican National Committee, part of Campaign 2020. The U.S. Embassy in London confirming today that an American national was among the three victims of a terrorist stabbing in the U.K. on Saturday evening. Three people were killed, three others were injured. In the incident just outside of London, a 25-year-old man has been arrested and police are classifying it as a terrorist incident. The issue came up today during question time in the House of Commons. Matt Rota is a member of Parliament with this to Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The last few days have been very difficult for our town. I want to offer my deepest condolences to the families of those who died in the dreadful attack in Forbury Gardens on Saturday evening. It is impossible to imagine what they are going through. My thoughts are also with the injured and their families and with all those who have been affected by this terrible attack. And I would like to thank Thames Valley Police and the other emergency services for their swift and effective response and for the incredible bravery shown by officers. Will the Prime Minister ensure that the investigation now receives all the resources it needs and that our town is properly supported? We have a strong and diverse community. We can and we will get through this together.
Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Honourable Member for his question and for the way he expressed it, because I think the whole House shares his feelings of support for the police, for their acknowledges their bravery in running towards danger, and also the members of the public who themselves intervened. It was a really extraordinary moment, but it was also, of course, an appalling crime and an appalling tragedy, and we will make sure that obviously there's a case that must now be properly proceeded with, and I would just make two comments. First of all, if there are any lessons that we need to learn about the way we handle things in the future, then we will of course learn those lessons and act in this Parliament and by this government. But secondly, as I said yesterday to the House, and I think it's a common view, we will not let this kind of attack, we will not let this kind of senseless murder distract us or in any way allow us to be intimidated or to change our way of life.
That's from the House of Commons earlier today and the British Prime Minister. And as we first reported yesterday, European Union nations could potentially block visitors from countries with severe coronavirus outbreaks, including those here in the U.S. A number of news organizations, including the New York Times, reporting that as European countries prepare to reopen their borders to international travel, officials at the European Commission have been working with member states on advising which visitors might be considered safe to visit after July 1st and those that would be barred from entering countries like Germany, Italy, and France. With more than 2.3 million cases here in the U.S., we have the highest number of coronavirus cases and infections in the world. At a State Department news conference earlier today, these comments by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
So as for your second question, we've been working with countries all across the world, including our friends in Europe and the EU proper, to determine how it is we can best safely reopen international travel. It's important for the United States to get Europeans the capacity to travel back to the United States. It's important, very important for the Europeans to fully reconnect with the American economy as well. I think leaders all across those two places understand the importance of this. And so we've been working with them for quite some time on this. I am confident that we will find a set of conditions that create sufficient health and safety protections, sufficient travel opportunity that will get the private sector. That's important in this too. We have to make sure that we have all of the elements in place to reopen travel between the EU and the United States. We're working on finding the right way to do that, the right timing to do it, the right tactics to have in place. We certainly don't want to reopen a play that jeopardizes the United States from people traveling here, and we certainly don't want to cause problems anyplace else. I'm very confident in the coming weeks we'll figure that out, as between not only the United States and the EU, but the United States and other parts of the world too. The State Department, Department of Transportation, Homeland Security are all working to develop plans and methods by which we can begin to get global travel back in place.
That from the Secretary of State. CNN.com, though, is reporting that reciprocity may be a consideration. Keep in mind the U.S. severely restricted travel from large parts of Europe back in March and April due to concerns over coronavirus. And during a meeting with White House reporters back in March, Counselor Kellyanne Conway made the reference to Kung Flu, saying it was, quote, highly offensive over the weekend, as you know, the president using that very same reference during a campaign rally in Tulsa. And so today, Kellyanne Conway was asked to respond.
Sure. My reaction is that the president has made very clear he wants everybody to understand, and I think many Americans do understand, that the virus originated in China, and had China been more transparent and honest with the United States and the world, we wouldn't have all the death and destruction that, unfortunately, we've suffered. And that's important as it be continued important. I saw a report within the last month that roughly the number of Americans who regard China as a, quote, adversary has jumped in the polls from 11% to 31%. That's obviously owing to this global pandemic that we're suffering, that China does not deny responsibility, and we'll continue to look at that. I'm glad you're joining us, Wajda, because I still invite you up here to tell us who said that. And I think that would be a very important revelation for us. That's not a source for you to protect. That's somebody who shouldn't have said that, and you're claiming did say that, and we still don't know who that was. You're changing the subject. I think you should have done... No, I'm not, Wajda. No. Yeah, you missed that. We already talked about that.
And that from the White House earlier today, and Counselor Kellyanne Conway.
R1, R2, R3, take me out to the...
A classic from Harry Carey and the Chicago Cubs during the 1980s. And while baseball fans this year may not be singing the song in the ballpark, MLB announcing late yesterday that players will begin training next Wednesday, and the season will officially begin on July 23rd. The playoffs will occur in October, so play ball. Baseball is back. Go Nationals, the World Series champs this past year. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. You can find it on our website at cspan.org/podcasts. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital for this Wednesday, June 24th. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.